Welcome to another IDEA webinar. We have a very special panel for you today. The panel is Dare to Date, Dating in a Time of Pandemic. And yes, we are talking safety again because it is paramount right now. This is a great concern for us all, of course. And we are in an interesting position of having a very great responsibility in the way that we nudge and cajole and guide our members in their dating behavior. Should they be dating yet? How should they be dating? We have an esteemed panel to help you answer that question and guide your members. So the Internet Dating Excellence Association exists to help you grow your company and to help the dating industry grow overall. I'd like to ask Jeff Cook. We have Jeff Cook on the call. He's the CEO and co-founder of the Meet Group, of course. And he has brought this group of epidemiologists and doctors together, physicians, to advise us. I'd like to ask Jeff, why did you pull together the Safer Dating Advisory Board? Why this board and why now?
Yeah, so we feel that it's critical to provide scientifically sound, practical guidelines to help minimize harm related to dating and meeting new people in an age of pandemic, and especially with respect to dating. And so, that's really what's driving this. We talked to a number of different infectious disease experts, epidemiologists, doctors Hazra, Afassi, and Sharp all stood out as having deep backgrounds in public health and medicine. And so, we're very pleased to benefit from their guidance and support as we try to provide good tips to our members. What's relatively clear to us is that, society is beginning to open up, obviously unevenly and in different places. But we recently ran a survey, an external survey of daters in the United States. So an independent panel balanced on age and gender. And we found 81% of daters would be willing to go on an in-person date tomorrow if they met someone interesting on a dating app today. What's more, in the same panel, we found 25% said they had dated someone in the last 30 days. Which actually is a figure that was very much in line with our own internal surveys, which suggested 23%. And so, seeing this type of data, the only real question is how to keep users safe and minimize risk. And that same survey revealed, 71% of users, of daters, prefer that their first date wear a mask, which I found interesting, a little bit encouraging. And as we've been very focused on building out live streaming solutions with respect to dating since 2016. And we think video has an important role to play as a filter in limiting real life interactions while also improving the dating interactions, allowing you to filter on things like appearance, personality, et cetera, before you meet up in person. So, it was kind of seeing this data, understanding our users and what they're doing, that led us to look to create a Safer Dating Advisory Board to help provide these scientifically sound tips and also help guide the practices of the company with respect to existing and new products that we might be releasing.
Thank you, Jeff. So I'd like to ask Dr. Melissa Sharp the first question. Let me give you a quick introduction, actually. So Dr. Melissa Sharp is an epidemiologist and postdoctoral fellow at the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. And she has an expertise specifically in meta-research and observational mixed methods research. So Dr. Sharp, and actually the entire panel, I'd like to ask you, what's your thoughts on where the pandemic stands in its current progression around the USA, and also around Europe? I think that's where most of our audience are calling in from today, USA and Europe. So biggest population, so perhaps we can focus on that. And can people date right now is my key question for you, Dr. Shaw.
Sure. Thanks for that introduction and for having me. I think we're well over half a year in at this point, and it sounds a bit out there to even admit that right now, but we've learned so much in such a short amount of time. And even if you think of what treatments that we've learned about, the vaccine progress that we've made in terms of people adapting their daily lives, everyone has made an insane amount of progress in a very short period of time. So I think that everyone from, you know, your average Joe to the people at the WHO need to give themselves credit that we have come a very far way in a short amount of time. There is a lot to be done still, but I think that, you know, there has been a lot of progress made. And you're seeing that play out some places in the U.S. So some states have it very under control, that they have sort of done the phased sort of unlockdowns of things, and they're reopening, and the contact tracing is in place, and things are starting to return back to normal somewhat. In other states, unfortunately, things are not going so smoothly. So I think that there's a very interesting gradient that's happening in the U.S., a little bit in Europe as well, but Europe largely, that's where I am right now, has it a bit more under control. So I think that the dating situation is very dependent on where you are. But, you know, things are returning back to normal a bit, certainly in some places. And I think that, you know, as long as we can go forward with the right advice and full knowledge of the risks that both we personally are taking and also that we might be subjecting others to, then I think that, you know, it is possible to continue to connect with people in new ways.
Thank you, Dr. Shah. And Dr. Anu Hazra, let me give you your quick introduction. You are an internal medicine and infectious disease physician certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine, and you're assistant professor of infectious diseases at University of Chicago. I'd like to ask you the same question. Where do we stand in the progression in the USA and the Europe, and can people date right now?
Yeah, thank you for the introduction. And again, reiterating, thank you for having this panel. I think this is would be super, super helpful hopefully for many folks. I think where we are currently in this pandemic, it varies greatly based on where you live. So looking even in the United States, I would say this pandemic has progressed in a way that when we think about society reopening, we can't think of it as a unidirectional linear process, that we need to become comfortable that this progression is going to be bidirectional. And that as this pandemic or the infection rates ebb and flow throughout the country, we need to be flexible to reopen and then potentially close or move back. And moving back isn't a failure and shouldn't be thought of as, you know, something that we should be trying to avoid. We should really be going by where we are on the numbers and trying to provide guidance that changes from time to time. So I think what's the most important thing for us to be able to provide for our clients or our patients is that ability to be flexible. As we start to see cases rise in certain parts of the United States and fall or stabilize in other parts. The concern in the United States potentially is while some states in the Northeast have very well controlled and have reduced the amount of person-to-person transmission, it is potentially only a matter of time before states that are not in control will potentially spread into the states that are. And that's just a microcosm of the world as well, that countries that have it currently under control, there's no guarantee that it will remain under control until there is a vaccine, unless public health officials remain vigilant and create barriers or some sort of blockades to move forward as the numbers potentially start to rise or case positivity starts to rise. As far as is it safe to date or can people date in this time, I think human connection is a part of our nature and we can't ignore it. I think the time of stay at home has expired and it's not a sustainable plan. I think as we envision what the next 3, 6, 9 months look like, we have to create some sort of personal change that is sustainable over a period of time. And if that means creating new innovative ways of dating, or having sort of personal interactions dating sort of processes, then we need to sort of start embracing other ways that we can do that, and that can be sustained over a period of time itself.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Nasra. And Dr. Tali Alfassi, you're an epidemiologist and research assistant professor of epidemiology in the Department of Public Health Sciences at the University of Miami. Thank you for joining us. And I'd like to ask you the same question. Where are we at, and can people date now?
Sure. Thank you for having me. So I'd like to, echo a lot of the sentiments from Drs. Hazra and Sharp, that first of all, in terms of where we are in the pandemic, I still believe that we're in the early phases. The most optimistic projections regarding a vaccine show that by the end of this year, potentially there will be a vaccine, but it will still require a massive public health effort to vaccinate essentially the entire population. So we're looking at, at least another year of this reality being the new normal. So with that said, I don't think it is realistic to have some sort of, essentially an abstinence-only policy where people and young individuals are told that they should not be dating. And I just don't think that's realistic. In terms of, where the pandemic stands at the moment, there is a great amount of heterogeneity based on geography, as was stated. So, for example, in the Northeast, the rates are somewhat under control. In the Southeast, where I am currently, we have massive community spread, right? So that really paints a very different picture from what's occurring in the Northeast. To echo Dr. Hazra's sentiments, in order to control the situation in somewhere like the Southeast, we would require a rollback of a lot of the openings that have occurred. Whether there is political will or not is to be determined, but that really should influence dating behaviors of people and just, regular social behaviors. So I would say that in a region like the Northeast, I personally, if I were put in a situation where I was to meet someone new, would feel more comfortable with new social engagements in areas where the case rates are lower versus somewhere like the Southeast. So I think the geography of the pandemic is really key. And we do need, flexibility in, whether certain risks can be taken in certain locations. So to echo Dr. Hazra's sentiments, I really think that that's key, but that it is possible to date in this new world as long as you have, as long as everyone takes precautions and, for example, wears a mask and just simple things that should be done that can be dependent on geography.
Great, great, great. So it sounds like this is very much, we're going to have to remain flexible, and we're really going to have to focus regionally to some level. I'd like to throw in an additional question. I'm looking at covidly.com, for example, covidly.com. But that doesn't show the regional mapping in the USA. Is there a particular resource that you would recommend that we look at that gives that kind of regionality in the USA? Europe is easy, it's on Covidly, but actually state by state. I mean, it really is a patchwork quilt right now, isn't it? Is there a particular resource that any of you would point towards as being useful for us to look at for the state by state numbers?
I would recommend Johns Hopkins has a very nice visual dashboard that's quite easy to use. You can look at both worldwide and state breakdowns. And also some states do have county by county breakdowns, like I know Florida does. So I would recommend either trying to find as local of information as you can So you can even look up your local public health department. If not, your state, and if not, Johns Hopkins has a good visual dashboard.
Great, thank you so much. So
I would also, sorry, just to add, I would also say that the local government, local press is covering it. So for example, in Florida, people are aware that there is a surge in South Florida. I mean, it is on the news every day. So to just pay attention to, you know, local news and guidelines issued by the local governments.
Thank you. Great. Yeah, it seems to be a week by week, even almost a day by day thing, but to be kind of monitoring the progress on these resources week by week is probably an ideal for us. So my next question for you is, the pandemic obviously has changed the way people date right now, but how can dating app leaders sensibly and responsibly advise internet daters to behave right now? Of course, we're in a position of great responsibility. It's not our, you know, we can't control people's behavior, but we're very much in a position of being able to nudge and guide them in their behavior. So should we advise them to date? How exactly should we advise them to date? And what do you think is the best advice? What are the best tips that we should be passing on that are scientifically sound? How would you advise us on those lines? So let's start with Dr. Sharp.
Sure. So I would think of it as sort of three C's, to emphasize communication, caution, and also creativity. So I think to have these conversations up front, you know, you can do it via text, you can do it via video, and to talk about things that might put yourself or other at risk. And so to establish that first, because if you want to eventually meet the person in person, then it's good to know sort of, you know, what their day-to-day life is like, who they're interacting with, where they are, where they've been, things like that. Also, that ties into the caution thing. You know, you don't want to just say, hey, okay, let's meet up immediately. So, you know, to try to slow things down a bit, take your time. And also, if you do decide to meet up, be creative with it. Perhaps, you know, before it just used to be, you know, this is your one spot that you take dates or something. But maybe, you know, you both have a sport in common that you play. You know, tennis is a great example of that. You're very far away, but, you know, you can still get to know, you know, someone in a new way. You can go on picnics. You know, we're lucky, you know, that it's summer right now. Being outside is better. I think it's just, you know, trying to, if you do meet up, to be creative with it and to sort of, you know, use it as a new opportunity to, you know, take chances in a different way.
Gotcha. Thank you, Dr. Sharp. Dr. Hazra?
Yeah, I think the first thing that's important is to validate what they're feeling, validate their frustrations that they may have been dealing with the past few weeks and or months rather, and say this is, you know, this is normal to feel this way, that you want to go out, you want to date, you want to see people, you want to touch people and have that in-person interaction. I think it's important to at least set that kind of tone first and then talk about how risk is not binary. It's not an on-off switch. It's not that if I do this, my risk is zero, and if I do this, my risk is 100. Risk is a gradient, and it's really important for everyone to understand how that applies to their own lives, both in terms of dating and everything else, really. And to really understand that what activities fall in what part of the gradient influences or informs what risk that you take for yourself or the people around you. And then emphasizing what is considered low risk and that you can still have in-person interactions, like Dr. Sharp said, outdoors or playing non-contact sports where you are socially distanced as well. These are all lower risk activities that people can take advantage of. You know, bars, indoor dining, all of these are extremely high risk environments and these really should be avoided. And in my opinion, still avoid regardless of where you are in the opening, because we do see these spikes or these surges happening as soon as the local governments open these closed indoor places that people interact very close to each other. And then the last thing is really to avoid shame. I mean, working in sexual health, we know that shaming does not work. We know that abstinence-only messaging does not work. Mask shaming does not work either. Shaming people to wear masks or shaming people to socially distance is not a constructive way of inducing behavioral change. It's really based on validation and some sort of education that you can inform your clients on what they can do to keep themselves safe, as well as the people they live with or the people they eventually go on dates with.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Hajra. Dr. Alfassi?
Sure. I think that the first thing that we can do is really encourage people to use video platforms. If you can reduce the amount of people that you're seeing, so I know that, you know, a lot of individuals serial date, and that's fine, but if you can really vet people through the video platform and minimize the amount of new people that you're meeting, that is great. Secondly, just, you know, to encourage simple strategies, you know, just remind people, wash your hands, have honest conversations with potential daters about, you know, how you feel about wearing a mask. For example, if you are, you know, a mask person versus not a mask person, maybe that's not the best option for you, you know, so just be transparent. So encourage daters to be transparent with how they feel and also their activities so that you give the other person, the other dater on the other line, the opportunity to assess their own risk. You know, they would potentially want to know how many new people you're interacting with, whether you're interacting indoors or whether you are, you know, in the office every day or in a high risk environment. So transparency is really key. And then I would also echo, you know, what the other doctors have said, that if you do choose to meet someone, meeting outdoors is really the best option, irrespective of where you are. You know, if you're in New York versus Miami, you probably still want to meet outdoors anyway, just to be safe. And the other thing I would say is really consider where you are geographically. If there is a major surge going on in your city or location, even if there is no stay-at-home order issued, it might be best to wait it out a little bit and get creative and chat with more people over video versus in-person interactions.
To that point, I wonder how much of a lag there is before we get to know. So for example, in Malta, which is where I'm situated right now, we're at onesie-twosie cases each day. And I can't help thinking, when are we gonna see the bump? Because we're kind of thinking it's going to be November, we're going to be rolling back, and the borders may well be shut. There's a kind of general sense, general preparation for November being the time at which we've got to lock things down again. My concern here is you look at those numbers, but where there's a 14-day window, right? So you look at the general numbers, but how quickly can it spike? You know, at what level? You know, what? Say if I'm looking at, how do you know? How do you really know? You look at numbers which are kind of level, but they could go up at any time. Could we get lulled into a false sense of security?
So I believe that you can easily get lulled into a false sense of security. So one way to look at it is you can look at the case positivity rate. How many people are testing positive? If you see that tend to spike, that's going to occur before the hospitalizations and the mortality rates go up. So you can look at other metrics that are released to the public to see what the trends look like in your area.
Great, thank you.
And this virus isn't magic. I mean, it follows the trends of any other infection. When you think about if the state next to you is surging, and you live in a city bordering that state, then you should expect a surge in your city or your location if proper measures aren't being taken. So yeah. If you're looking at what areas are surrounding you and if those areas are surging, then that becomes a risk indicator for where you live, unless there's some sort of precautions or some sort of blocks in place to prevent that from happening.
Great, thank you. Jeff, we've had some great advice on what we should be advising our users. You have advised users, you've got some general guidance out. What exactly is the Meet Group's position on this right now? What are you advising users to do?
Sure, so we have tips that are available to all of our users. And some of those tips are the same ones you've heard here today. Check local warnings, government protocols, pre-screen your dates on video to the extent that you are able to. Video is excellent at providing a sense of how authentic a person is, providing a sense of their personality, their sense of humor, but also whether they're coughing or not. You could ask them, do they live in a multi-generational household? It's just a very helpful pre-screening measure. Risk factors, discussing risk factors, whether on video or on text-based chat, openly. Don't go on a date if either party is sick or has been recently sick or in contact with someone who is. As you've heard, keeping initial dates outside and in public is important. But if you do go inside, then wear a mask and minimize your time spent there. It's important to keep boundaries. Common sense advice is still important. Hand washing, not touching your face. I probably have done it a few times this Zoom. And being choosy with who you meet. Not really a time to be meeting a new person every day.
Gotcha. Thank you, Jeff. At the end of the day, we've all got platforms that are meant for people to get to know each other a bit better. And, very key to that is that they use them. People spend a bit more time on our platforms to get to know people and vet them and ask these key questions before going on a date. In some ways it could well permanently change people's dating behavior. It could get people to kind of discover the tools that are available to them, like, more instant messaging, more video, and more voice online. Essentially, they've got the facility now to do the first date online. Hopefully things will return to normal next year and things, but what is that normal? So I'd like to ask you, what would be the leading indications that people can return back to their normal dating behavior? What are those leading indicators that we should be looking for, Dr. Sharp?
I'm not the biggest fan of the word normal. I haven't been for many years, but I think that, if we think about it more as trying to get people uncomfortable with a sense of uncertainty, I think that normal would be essentially when we have a vaccine and when it is able to be rolled out on a large scale. And unfortunately, even with accelerated timelines, I think that is very far, far in the future. So I think it's more important to essentially sort of try to redefine it of this is normal now. And so it's going to be normal for a while. Before maybe it wasn't that normal to have web conferences, but now everybody's used to it. So I think it's just trying to redefine that a bit, in terms of, dating and things like that. I think it's been said multiple times about it's really about your geography. As community spread can be suppressed to a certain degree, then that's as close as you can get to sort of, the old normal that we're thinking of. But yeah, I think the community spread and having the proper public health contact tracing and things like that, that's the biggest sort of indicator of trying to return to the sort of old normal.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think dating, I think the word normal, some people might interpret to mean, as it used to be. And I actually don't think dating will return to the way it used to be, in the sense that you might, based on a shallow, right swipe on a dating app, you meet up in person with someone at the local coffee shop or bar. I think because of those consumer, changing consumer habits in the last 3 to 4 months, we essentially got 3 to 4 years of changing consumer habits as it relates to willingness to live stream. It's not a strange question to ask someone, especially a potential date, to live stream before you meet up. People are using live streaming in all aspects of their life And I think the dating landscape will be forever changed by this pandemic, in the sense that video will become just a filter, not necessarily a replacement for human interaction, but a filter. But you know, I also think normal probably means something different to every person.
New normal, really. Dr. Hazra.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, we've been transforming the way we date all the time. I mean, 20 years ago, how did we date or find partners versus now? This is just another part of that progression. So I agree with Dr. Sharp and Jeff that normalcy, quote unquote, I don't think will ever return. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Being able to potentially filter folks on video helps out in a lot of different ways than having to meet everyone in person all the time. In terms of like key sort of like discrete ways of thinking about when things can progress to, you know, more in person, I mean, Dr. Alfasi talked about case positivity rates, and that's really important to take a look at. That's always available on any dashboard that you look at from your state or local governments. But a positivity rate below 3% typically means that there is some sort of control over community transmission. Once that rises above 5% and goes towards 20%, then you know this pervasive, widespread person-to-person transmission of the virus itself. And so positivity is again one metric that you can take a look at to see whether it is safer to meet people outdoors or in person than not.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Hazra. And actually, I'd just like to note, we can do some Q&A. If you've got some questions you'd like to ask our esteemed panel, I really urge you to do so. This is going to be a rare opportunity for you. Please do use this opportunity. If you'd like to enter some questions now, I'll review the questions and bubble them up. So please put some thought into the Q&A, and I'll review them in a few minutes, and we can bubble them up for the panel. So, Dr. Alfasi.
Just to add, you know, there also is potentially a place for testing as well. If we are at a place in the U.S. where tests are widely available and you can get the results immediately, you know, within 24 hours, then that's a potential resource that could really help with in-person dating, especially for people who are maybe going out more than others. You would want to get tested often. But again, this resource isn't really useful unless you can get results quickly. And that's not necessarily the case at the moment in the US. So there would still need to be a rapid, you know, ramp up of testing.
One of the other things I'd heard about the testing is that it's not, if you, you may not show positive and be positive. So how reliable are the tests? And how quickly do you know if you've got it, but you're entirely asymptomatic, how do you know?
So, go ahead, please. So in general, from time of exposure to positive test is about 5 to 7 days, where the virus has enough time to replicate in your body that it registers positive on a nasal swab or oropharyngeal swab. You know, and that's the same for symptomatic folks or asymptomatic folks. That's also why typically around day 5 or day 7 after exposure, people who do develop symptoms develop symptoms. And so the best time to really get tested after a potential high exposure event or, you know, something like that would be about a week out from there. People, you know, we have a good amount of data to know that for immunocompetent individuals, their viral shedding really lasts about 10 days where they're really transmissible from the time of infection onwards. And so really that's where the guidance of 10 to 14 days of self-quarantine really come from. As far as the testing goes, the PCR testing, that's the testing that actually looks for viral replication, is actually very sensitive and very specific. These are the tests done in the machines. The rapid testing, which is the Abbott ID Now platform, that's the one that the current presidential administration uses on a regular basis. That is also, that unfortunately is not really as accurate as the majority of other testing being done in the country itself. But testing, like Dr. Valsi mentioned, is only as good as how fast we can get results. You know, in many parts of this country, people are waiting 10 to 14 days to get a test result back. And that makes that essentially defeats the entire purpose of getting a test. Because if you're asking someone to self-isolate for 14 days and we don't even know what their test results are for 14 days, then what's the point of even getting that test? It also impacts contact tracing. How can you go back 2 weeks and contact someone and know who they're interacting with 2 weeks ago? And so that's where we say that, you know, testing itself has still become a huge obstacle that this country, meaning the United States, has yet to overcome. But the actual tests themselves are accurate. It's just trying to get that lag time to be decreased to something like 24 hours.
I see. Yeah, that would be the ideal. Now, there is another kind of test which actually shows if you have had it in the past. How reliable is that test? What's the name of that test? I forget the name of it, but...
Yeah, so that's the antibody test. So after any infection that you ever have in your life, your body develops a memory of that infection. Part of that memory is called an antibody. So we use antibody testing to help diagnose, you know, history of very different types, other types of infections, HIV, hepatitis. All of these develop antibodies that we test for, and we can tell if someone's been exposed or had the infection in the past. The concern or the issue with the current coronavirus antibody testing is its accuracy. And so I am a proponent of not letting perfect be the enemy of good. There's still some benefit from antibody testing, but it really has to be interpreted through a narrow scope, meaning that we see about a 15% false positive and a 15% false negative rate with antibody testing itself. So antibody testing can't be the end all be all of knowing someone's COVID status. We know some patients, so antibodies are, not to get too technical, but antibodies are created by a part of your immune system that is called B cells. And so you have B cells and T cells, and they work together to really to create your immune system itself. Antibodies are really testing your B cell function, but we know some people may not develop antibodies, but still have immunity through their T cell function. And so now we're trying to figure out tests to do this other part of your immune system itself. So that relates to the potential false negativity rate. And the concern with the false positivity rate is coronavirus is just a common cold virus. So there's hundreds of circulating coronaviruses that we have on a regular basis that you and I may have been infected with coronaviruses throughout our lives. And so we have antibodies to those old coronaviruses themselves. And so there is cross-reactivity between some of those that is still trying to be established. And so again, while antibody testing has a role, it's not something that I clinically would ever hang my hat on saying that this definitively tells me that this patient has had COVID in the past or not.
I see a couple of questions here which are very relevant to where we're at right now. So let me include these. Daniel Dietzek is asking us, when you say that the tests aren't useful unless you can get the results quickly, what time frame is quickly? If you had to wait 24 hours for your results, then wouldn't you have to need a quarantine for those 24 hours to ensure that those results were still valid? Also, are the rapid 1 to 5 hour tests as accurate as the other tests? Open panel.
So I think I can speak to this as I recently completed a quarantine. Here it's the standard is 14 days, and that's pretty much the standard of is quarantine is 14 days. Like was mentioned, you're not going to be able to have some results show until 5 to 7 days. Currently where I am in Ireland, some people are getting results in 72 hours. If I could test, a week in after I arrived and then I would get, a test, then possibly I could not have to do the second week of quarantine. So for people like essential workers, that might be helpful in terms of reducing the time needed to quarantine. But I wouldn't really hang my hat on that. I would rather be cautious than not, because, these things might be different. That's just my experience on that. Someone wants to handle the more technical side.
Thank you, Dr. Shah. Anything to add?
I think it's important to ask what type of test they've done. So most of the testing, the PCR testing, is actually done in a matter of hours. The majority of viral PCR testing, the longest one is the Roche platform that takes 3.5 hours to run. It's not the actual processing of the test, it's the backlog of tests that is taking the time. The actual testing process is relatively fast, but it's the fact that most of these facilities are overrun with tests or have to send out tests to facilities that are overrun with tests. That's what creates a backlog. So when we talk about rapid testing, we're talking about, so how do we get, so the tests that offer results in the matter of minutes would be two platforms right now. One is the ID Now, the Abbott ID Now platform that is widely utilized, but has been showing about a 30 to 50% false negativity rate. That is not something I clinically use because I do not feel like that is reliable. The Cepheid Gene Expert is another platform that gets results in about 45 to 90 minutes. And that is extremely reliable. However, that has not been scaled up to be able to be tested on a wide scale basis. So people are still sending out test results for the Cepheid Gene Expert. Where that's being utilized primarily right now in the United States is in emergency rooms, where we can quickly delineate if someone is positive or not while they're in the emergency room itself. But it has not been scaled out for walk-in testing or testing of people on the street itself. So it's important to know these tests are quick. It's not the actual process of the test that takes so much time. It's actually getting the test to the machine. That's what's the biggest time lag, at least in this country.
I see.
And to address the one of the original questions about timeline, Dr. Hazra had already answered this in his previous discussion, but really you want the tests back in 24 to 48 hours because beyond that, you know, you have people that are potentially not quarantining, and then that makes contact tracing very difficult. And you're essentially exposing, you know, if the test is positive, you are exposing people to coronavirus, you know, for however many days post-test you have. So you really want the shortest time frame to enable effective and efficient contact tracing.
Gotcha. To that point also, there's another question from Daniel. Thank you very much, Daniel, on listing COVID status. So here's the question. I've seen quite a few singles on some dating apps displaying their COVID antibody status. I assume they're showing that their results were reactive so that others will think they're safe and that typical safety measures don't have to be used. If we see this on our own app, do you think we have a responsibility to communicate with those members and explain that the logic is not evidence-based? Dr. Shah.
I would be very, very cautious with that. I think, you know, you're seeing it sometimes when people wear masks, they sort of think that it's an invisible bubble and they're not social distancing. And I think that sort of the core behavioral changes are not going to change. You're going to always need to wash your hands more, to not touch your face as much, and to wear the mask, and to stay further away if you can. Just because you're sort of doing one thing doesn't mean that the other ones go away. So I think that it'd be more, I would be more interested in hearing and seeing someone's mask, like show me your style, like what's your different kind of masks you're wearing. I'd be more interested in that and the behavioral aspect. And I think that would tell me more than someone trying to sort of hang their hat on a test result.
I love that. I think it's a great way of making
it. You also can't trust the test result, right? So just because someone posts something on their profile doesn't make it a medical test.
And there's also, we still don't know, you know, how long immunity lasts. So the science is still, you know, not out on all that. So it's just best and it's good practice to just take precautions.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And even if people can have it twice. Sorry, Dr. Hazra.
So, right, to the point of the reinfection, we know that after a certain infection, you're potentially conferred immunity. I think the CDC just released about 3 months is what we're looking at the very least, and that evidence will grow as we can see, and there hasn't been a cluster of true reinfections or proven reinfections just yet. So we know that an infection does confer some immunity, but like how Dr. Alfasi mentioned, we have no idea how long that immunity lasts. And so that is what's unknown. Antibody testing in general, given its sort of issues of accuracy, think of it as like a Monet, that when you see it very close, you can't really make much out of it. But on a population level, seroprevalence data is very useful. And so the reason why there are certain cities or municipalities are doing widespread antibody testing is not to make individual level decisions, but to make population level decisions, because then you can see potential seroprevalence of a population itself. But I would not use antibody testing as like a free ticket or a get out of jail free card for them. And I would try to educate users about the issues surrounding antibody testing and why we can't really rely on that as a way to keep them safe. And there's much other better options to do that for them.
Gotcha. It must be very tempting from the user perspective. If they've had coronavirus, they say, look, I've had it, I'm good. Or even if they've had a test recently, and it's just, I could see that being an area of risk for us as dating app operators we certainly, you know, our guidance is very key in that aspect as well. Jeff, anything to add based on what you've heard today? Are there any more takeaways that you'd like to bubble up?
No, I mean, I think this was a good discussion. You know, I think the types of things we're thinking about going forward is, you know, is there guidance for, you know, we've put out some guidance as it relates to first dates. You know, is there guidance we can put out for, you know, trying to move a relationship to a second date or a third date? What would that look like in different scenarios? You know, how do you, is there a way to think about intimacy, in a pandemic? And so I think, I think this advisory board will have, a lot to say about that. And we hope to have, or we may well put out something with respect to that, in the future. But, I think this is exactly what the dating industry needs in terms of fact-based, scientifically sound guidance, making it available in an approachable way in the app itself. I think that's what we're trying to do here.
Great. Jeff Cook, thank you so much for bringing the board and making them available to us for this webinar. I appreciate all of your time. Thank you so much, Dr. Sharp, Dr. Hazra, and Dr. Alfasi. We'll be running this on OPW in about 10 days' time, and we'll also run a summary of your advice. And again, I appreciate your time, and on behalf of the Internet Dating Executive Community, welcome to the dating industry. So, all right, thank you so much. Speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.